Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My talk today is titled The Way of Beauty, the Church and the Arts. I'd like to start off with what's maybe an unusual way to begin a Thomistic Institute lecture, with singing. I'd like to begin with the introit for the dedication of a church. This is a beautiful chant that dates back to the early 7th century. The text in Latin that you're going to hear in a moment is Terribilis est locus iste, hic domus Dei est et porta celi, et vocabitur aula Dei. How awesome is this place! This is the house of God and the gate of heaven and will be called the court of God.
Terribilis est locus iste, hic domus Dei est, et porta celi, et vocabitur aula Dei.
So those notes you just heard, St. Thomas Aquinas himself would have sung. That's taken from the Dominican Gradual. It's a chant that goes back, as I said, to the 7th century. The origins of it are really fascinating, and they're a great example of what we're going to be exploring all throughout tonight's lecture. The connection between beauty, both of spaces, of physical things, of music, and the liturgy itself. So those chants were composed for the dedication of a very special church. We've been seeing some images of it in the slides already. It's the church called the Pantheon. So the word Pantheon means all the gods. But in the early 7th century, this ancient Roman building was made suitable for Christian worship. It was made into a church. And so these chants were composed by a group of singers in Rome in order to commemorate the very first dedication of this church. So think about these images. Perhaps you've seen the Pantheon either in person or in images. We're going to see more images of it. It's a truly awesome space, an awe-inspiring space. And these chants, written for the Pantheon, went on to become the chants that were sung for every Catholic church dedication throughout the whole world. Whether the church be very small and modest, or whether it be grand, like a cathedral. There's something about the arts that responds to the reality of the situation, and yet always points out or aspires to something more than meets the eye. The Pantheon, of course, has had lots of influence on architecture throughout church history. Here we've got a nice set of angles here. So Thomas Jefferson, a person not noted for his appreciation of Catholic liturgy, nevertheless had a great appreciation for the beauty of this space. And of course, we can think about the ambiguities of this as well. So Jefferson probably isn't imitating just the Catholic dimensions of the Pantheon's architecture, but also its noble Roman past. And yet, one of the reasons it's preserved is precisely because it became a church. It became not just a terrible pagan space, but an awesome Christian one. So how do the arts transform culture? How do they preserve culture and transmit it to the next generation? Tonight's talk is about the way of beauty. This is a phrase that the church has been reflecting on for several decades. It's rooted, though, in a much deeper, older experience. Shortly after the election of Pope Benedict XVI in 2005, the Pontifical Council for Culture wrote a whole document on the way of beauty. So I'd like to read one passage from this. Beginning with the simple existence of the marvel-arousing meeting with beauty, the via pulchritudinis, the way of beauty, can open the pathway for the search for God and dispose the heart and spirit to meet Christ, who is the beauty of holiness incarnate, offered by God to men for their salvation. It invites contemporary Augustines, unquenchable seekers of love, truth, and beauty, to see through perceptible beauty the way to eternal beauty, and with fervor discover Holy God, the author of all beauty. There's a lot of richness to this quotation. We're going to be exploring some of these themes throughout the talk. But the basic idea to take away to start with is that exterior beauties, the exterior realities we encounter, don't just exist in themselves, but they point to something beyond themselves. They point ultimately to their maker. So the church from the very beginning has recognized the importance of beauty. So the Psalms, of course, give us an important testimony to this. Psalm 96 says, "Give unto the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth." There's something about our action that can reflect beauty or disfigure it. There's a beautiful reflection on this same scriptural theme in a famous hymn. "O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Bow down before him, his glory proclaim. With gold of obedience and incense of lowliness, kneel and adore him. The Lord is his name." We're called to be lovers of spiritual beauty. That's a line from the Rule of St. Augustine, which, again, St. Thomas Aquinas would have read each week. To be a lover of spiritual beauty is ultimately to be a lover of the source of all beauty. God is the cause of all that is true, good, and beautiful. But even more, God is goodness, truth, and beauty itself. God isn't good simply because he causes goodness. He's good in himself. He causes goodness. He makes things beautiful because he is good, because he is beautiful. We name him with these names, the good, the true, and the beautiful, not as if our words can fully capture who he is, but because we can only describe him with words that derive from our own experience of the world that God has created, with words that he himself has revealed to us. Beauty is ultimately one of the most important paths we have to God. God is the creator of all that is beautiful, and thus all that is beautiful shares in God's beauty. God's beauty transcends all other beauties. God's so beautiful that he is, in a sense, even beyond beauty. There's not a scale with which we can compare his beauty to other forms. And yet, God's beauty inspires us. It inspires us to strive to seek beauty, as well as to become more beautiful ourselves. There's a beautiful passage in John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor, which expresses these themes. That document is about the beauty or splendor of truth. John Paul speaks very convincingly and beautifully about the importance of truth, of seeking truth. But we don't seek truth in isolation. We seek it alongside beauty. Here we have a picture of John Paul with his would-be assassin, Mehmet Ali Agha, as he's forgiving him. So this is a beautiful quote that I think this sense of the mercy of John Paul towards his assassin helps us to understand the depth of what's going on here. "In order to perfect himself in his specific order, the person must do good and avoid evil. He must be concerned for the transmission and preservation of life, refine and develop the riches of the material world, cultivate social life, seek truth, practice good, and contemplate beauty." This is an amazing passage. It's capturing a lot of different ideas all at once. So these opening words about avoiding, seeking good and avoiding evil, this has to do with Thomas Aquinas' understanding of what are the fundamental precepts of the natural law. What are all human beings called to do? Fundamentally, we're to seek good and avoid what is evil. And yet, there's more to life than just that basic precept, fundamental as it is. We have to transmit what we've received, the good of human life, of human families. But then there's also the refining of what exists. But all of these natural things, which are good in themselves, lead to something even deeper, seeking truth, practicing good, and contemplating beauty. There's a great, I think, artfulness to this phrase. The contemplation of beauty is, in a sense, the fruit of all of these other things. It can only be fully carried out if everything else is in order, and yet, in some sense, it's the goal of all of these other things. Goodness, truth, and beauty are deeply interchangeable and intertwined. Think about the problem of trying to tell the truth without goodness, without real desire for the other person. There can be a cruelty to it. Sometimes we've heard true things said about ourselves, but we sense that they weren't told in a spirit of goodness, and there's a great harmfulness that comes from that. On the other hand, the truth can be said without beauty, and that is boring. As the poet Jeffrey Hill once put it, a good idea badly expressed is not a good idea. Truth, beauty, and goodness need to be together. Goodness without truth is annoying. Goodness without beauty is unattractive. Beauty without goodness is seductive. It might lead us astray. Beauty without truth is deceptive. We need to strive to seek all three of these in a united way. Thomas Aquinas, as in so many other areas, is a great guide for us in this path. In the Summa, he gives us a famous and important definition of beauty. He says, species, that's the Latin form for beauty, or beauty, has a likeness to the property of the sun. So here he's talking in the context of Trinitarian theology. He's linking beauty with the Son of the Eternal Trinity, the Son of God. For beauty includes three conditions: integrity or perfection, since those things which are impaired are by that very fact ugly; due proportion or harmony; and lastly, brightness or clarity, whence things are called beautiful when they have a bright color. So again, I think here we have a sense of the interconnection of beauty with the other elements of the divine attributes. So beauty has to be integrated. There has to be a proportion between it and the other things. It has to have an attractiveness to it. Ultimately, beauty is something that helps us see it and contemplate it, and yet look beyond it. So this is, again, a deeply scriptural theme. The Book of Wisdom speaks about how, from the greatness and beauty of created things, their original author, by analogy, is seen. So from contemplating any beautiful object, here we've got something from Yosemite National Park, it's a chance to think about what's the source of all of this. Of course, we can think on a purely natural level, you know, different natural processes that lead to things, and yet that God, in some sense, has brought all of this into being. It's helping us by analogy to see the author of all that exists. Experiencing beauty helps us to understand the beauty of God himself. We can see the clarity of a created form as a gift of God. We can see its integrity as something that exists. And finally, we follow it back to God in proportionate order. So Thomas's definition of beauty helps us see how all created things are not just something existing in themselves, but pointing back to God in proportion. God has created all that exists, not out of any necessity, as if it had to exist, but out of pure gift and pure love. Here we have a Bible missal, in fact, related to my monograph we were hearing about earlier. This is a beautiful missal made for a Dominican friar, and it has at the very beginning of it these depictions of the 7 days of creation. So what these are helping us to see, both the images as well as the biblical story of creation, is that God creates everything, and everything that he creates is good. He sees it as being good. But humanity, of course, he says, is very good. There's a way in which there's a proportion of goodness. The natural world, good as it is only one part of God's creation. Human beings are very good. We're sharing in God's beauty and in God's goodness in a special way. S- The Psalms likewise testify to this creative evocation of God's beauty. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims the work of his hands. Everything that has been made is pointing us back to God. But man and woman are in the image of God, in the likeness of God. In Genesis, we hear this: "Let us make human beings in our image, after our likeness." And God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. For Aquinas, we're in the image of God, most of all insofar as we are rational. We're able to share in God's inner thought, his inner ability to reason. We do it, of course, in a created mode, never equal to him. And yet, we're able to share even in his creativity, in a sense. In the Summa, Thomas says, "Some things are like to God, first and most commonly, because they exist. Second, they live. And thirdly, because they know or understand. It is clear, therefore, that intellectual creatures alone, properly speaking, are made to God's image." So everything that exists is, in some sense, in God's image. It's like God, insofar as it exists. But a living creature is even more like God, because God is alive. But human beings, being able to know, to reason, to love, we're even more so in God's image. Beauty plays an important part in carrying out, living out this way of being in God's image, because we need reason in order to recognize what's beautiful, as well as to contribute to what's beautiful. Of course, through sin, the image of God in each of us has not been completely taken away, but it's been marred, it's been damaged. But through the incarnation, through the paschal mystery of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, and through the sacraments, we are given the ability to be refashioned in God's beauty, to both restore, not through our own power, but through God's grace, that sense of oneness with him, as well as to be images of that beauty to others. St. Catherine of Siena has a beautiful line in her dialogue: "We are your image, and you are our image, on account of the union which you made in man, veiling the eternal deity with a miserable cloud and the unmade lump of clay of the flesh of Adam." So God has made us in his image, but in the incarnation of Christ, he has taken on our image and likeness. So it's through Christ somehow that we are able not only to be restored to oneness with God, but also to share in his very process of this beautiful recreation. The liturgy is one of the primary ways in which we carry out this task. By our internal worship of God with our hearts and souls, as well as our external worship with our bodies, with all that we create, with what we sing, the way we move our bodies, all of these are part of living out and restoring this image of God. In Christmas, we have a beautiful preface for the Mass, that part of the Mass leading up to the Eucharistic prayer, after "the Lord be with you and with your spirit, lift up your hearts," and so forth. This is a very powerful passage that Thomas Aquinas quotes again and again in his writing. It's a very important way of thinking about the relationship of the external world to our knowledge of God. "For in the mystery of the Word made flesh, a new light of your glory has shone upon the eyes of our mind, so that as we recognize in him God made visible, we may be caught up through him in love of things invisible." This helps us see that everything external is ultimately leading us toward the internal reality of God. Even the incarnation of Jesus Christ has a purpose beyond itself, which is to unite us with the Father, to draw us into the divine nature of the Trinity. The beauty of the liturgy is an important way of living this out. God doesn't need our worship. There's nothing we do that sort of satisfies a need he has. God wants us to worship him, though, because it's good for us to do so. God wants us to be in a right relationship with him, and our worship helps us to be more attuned to him. God has created us, and he wants a relationship with us. When we worship him, we're giving a little back to him. God loves us first, and we're giving some small return of that love. Through Jesus' incarnation, death, and resurrection, God teaches us how to worship him in spirit and in truth, and he gives us the means to do so. We're not just flailing out using our best initiative. We're responding to what he has taught us. Jesus' incarnation is itself a reminder of the goodness of the body and of our human nature. And so in the liturgy, following Christ's spiritual worship, we're able to unite our bodies and our souls in a single act of worship. By worshiping together in the liturgy, we're encouraging one another as social beings. God can, of course, understand our internal thoughts and our inward prayers. God doesn't need us to express them in order for him to know them. But by us expressing them in a beautiful way to him, we are able to articulate these realities more clearly to ourselves. Think of what Peter says to Jesus, "You know all things. You know that I love you." And yet it's Peter saying that aloud that's strengthening his own ability to love Jesus. Expressing our worship externally helps us to articulate to ourselves and to God our needs and desires. Think about saying, "I love you," to a spouse or a family member. It's helping to strengthen that bond. Beauty in worship is ultimately a way of this same external reality. It's helping to strengthen our sense of God and our ability to offer ourselves to him. Beauty has been an important part of the church's evangelization. Cardinal Ratzinger, the future Pope Benedict, famously said, "The only really effective apologia for Christianity comes down to two arguments, namely the art the church has, namely the saints the church has produced, and the art which has grown in her womb." This image would suggest a third effective apologia. The beauty of the liturgy for Pope Benedict is part of the very mystery of the incarnation. It's a sublime expression of God's glory, and in a certain sense, a glimpse of heaven on earth. The memorial of Jesus' redemptive sacrifice contains something of that beauty which Peter, James, and John beheld when the Master, making his way to Jerusalem, was transfigured before their eyes. Beauty, then, is not mere decoration, but rather an essential element of the liturgical action, since it's an attribute of God himself and his revelation. I'd like to spend a few minutes thinking about some concrete examples of beauty and the liturgy. So I'd like to start with the church we began with the Pantheon in Rome. Throughout the centuries, this has inspired many artists to try to capture something of that beauty of the church. Here we have a beautiful painting from the 18th century, as well as a more recent photograph. Think about what's expressed by this space, this great openness, an openness even to heaven itself. At Pentecost, they drop rose petals through. It's a very dramatic space, but you can think about the way this grandness is able to lift up the heart, to make one call upon God. And of course, we have to remind ourselves, this is a pagan church originally. This is a truly human impulse to reach up to God, but it's been purified and elevated through Christian worship. Here's an image of a different sort of shape, a cruciform church. This is the Cistercian Abbey of Fossa Nova, where Thomas Aquinas died on his way to the Council of Lyon. There's a whiteness, a bareness to it, and yet it's elevating our eyes. Its verticality through this early Gothic architecture is making us seek God, lifting up our hearts and our minds to him. This beautiful 18th century painting of St. Peter's in Rome has a similar grandeur, and yet here there's so much decoration. These are different ways of expressing the beauty of the house of God. This one is, in a certain sense, scintillating our imagination, our senses, more fully than that Cistercian one, and yet each has a different way of leading our hearts and minds to God. Here we see two different 20th century churches, or late 19th in the second case, St. Vincent Ferrer on the Upper East Side of New York City, and St. Ignatius Loyola in the same neighborhood. Each of these are, in a sense, representing the spirits of the orders which founded them, the Gothic Church of the Dominicans and this Baroque Church of the Jesuits. It's a reminder that artistic and architectural style in the history of the church has been very diverse. There's been lots of different ways of expressing beauty, and yet each of these are fundamentally sharing in the oneness of God's beauty, the oneness of the house of God. If we turn to the implements that we use for worship, there's also been a great specialization in beauty over the course of church history, and yet still a great diversity. So here we see two chalices, one from Ireland in the 8th century. These are both essentially the same height, but the Irish one is a much wider style. And then on the right, we see the chalice of Abbot Suger of Saint-Denis. In this case, he's taken an ancient cup and turned it into a chalice, similar to what happens with the Pantheon, a pagan church becoming a Christian site of worship. Each of these are capturing the beauty that needs to be given to the precious blood of Christ. Here we have another range of a Gothic chalice and a Baroque one, one made in America, one in Germany, centuries apart. Again, this smallness, the squatness of the one on the left and the tall elegance of the one on the right are two different expressions of the oneness of the Eucharist. This last image is a very poignant example. This is a very small chalice. It was used in the recusant era, when Catholics weren't allowed to worship in England. This one was made to be unscrewed and carefully transported in three sections. There's a great simplicity to this. It's much simpler, much less beautiful on one level than these last four we've seen. And yet it expresses a need to worship not only in the beauty of holiness, but also in the secrecy of what's necessary at this era. To look at some medieval manuscripts for a moment, we get a similar sense in this period of the High Gothic, 13th century, of different forms of beauty. A great artistic fullness in the one on the far, on your left, and these simpler forms of decoration. And yet all of them are fitting expressions of the same reality. So what we're taking away from this, at least in my view, is that there's many different ways to be beautiful in the history of the church, many different styles that have been cultivated. And yet a good thing is elevating us, helping us to worship God, helping us to look beyond the object itself to the fullness of the God who has created it. Liturgical beauty is something really essential for us to cultivate. It's something the church wants us to cultivate. And yet, we need to cultivate it in a way that's balanced, in a way that's connected to reality. The virtue of religion is a gift from God, but it's something we can grow in by exercising it, by doing good things over and over again. We're able to learn how to make them second nature. Liturgy, and guided by beauty, helps us to believe with our bodies, to truly be one with what we're doing. Developing a mature sense, a virtuous sense of worship, allows us to cultivate and prioritize the cultivation of the beauty of the liturgy. But it also lets us persevere in moments where the liturgy is not so beautiful, for reasons outside our control. Sometimes we might be visiting a parish where they do things differently. Sometimes we don't care for the musical style at our own parish. There's, of course, room for different opinions, but we have to make do with what exists sometimes. The virtue of religion helps us to make the best of whatever situation we find ourselves in, to recognize that worship is ultimately about giving glory to God, and that God knows our hearts and our desire to give him the best that we can offer. I'd like to conclude by sharing a story of an example of mature worship in extreme circumstances. This is the story of Francis Xavier Noyon Fontoine. Has anybody heard of him before in this room? Okay, a couple of you, right. Francis Xavier Noyon Fontoine was born in Vietnam in 1928. He was ordained a priest in 1953, consecrated a bishop in 1967. and then appointed the coadjutor bishop of Saigon in 1975. A few months after his appointment, the fall of Saigon happened, and this bishop was put into solitary confinement. He was in prison for the next 13 years, 9 years of which he lived in solitary confinement. He was deprived of all external forms of beauty. He was living out some of the most cruel forms of existence known to man. And yet, his maturity, the virtue of religion, which had been cultivated throughout his years as a Christian, his years as a priest, were able to help him in this time. "Were you able to say Mass in prison," he once wrote later after his release, "is a question I have been asked many, many times. And when I say yes, I can foretell the next question. How did you get the bread and wine? I was taken to prison empty-handed. Later on, I was allowed to request the strict necessities like clothing, toothpaste, and so forth. I wrote home saying, 'Send me some wine as medication for my stomach pains.' On the outside, the faithful understood what I meant. They sent me a little bottle of Mass wine with a label reading, 'Medication for stomach pains,' as well as some hosts broken into small pieces. The police asked me, 'Do you have pains in your stomach?' 'Yes.' 'Here is some medicine for you.' I will never be able to express the joy that was mine. Each day, 3 drops of wine, a drop of water in the palm of my hand. I celebrated my Mass. I spent 9 years in solitary confinement, and during that time, I said Mass every day at 3 o'clock, the hour of Jesus' death on the cross. I was all alone and could sing and chant whatever I wished in Latin, in French, and Vietnamese. I always carried with me that same tiny bag containing Jesus and the Blessed Sacrament. You in me and me in you. They were the most beautiful Masses of my life. I sang the Salve Regina and the Salve Mater and became one with the universal church. I could see from my cell the entire church, without boundaries, and in the rage of criticism and accusation against the church, I sang, 'Tu es Petrus, you are Peter, and upon this rock I shall build my church.' The presence of Jesus in the Eucharist consoles and unites us, vivifies and transforms us, like the pilgrims on the road to Emmaus." After these years in prison, Nguyen Phan Thuan was finally freed in 1988, but he was exiled from Vietnam. He spent the rest of his life serving in the Roman Curia. In the year 2000, he was given a chalice by John Paul II and made a cardinal. I can only imagine how meaningful it was for those hands, which had themselves become a chalice during his time in solitary confinement, to once again hold a chalice. He died in the year 2002 and was named Venerable by Pope Francis in 2017. I'd like to conclude with a beautiful quote from him, which I think helps to capture the importance of beauty as well as the fundamental reality of what beauty is pointing to. "You believe in one power, the blessed Eucharist, the body and blood of our Lord, which make you live. I have come that they may have life and have it more abundantly. As the manna fed the Israelites on their way to the promised land, so will the blessed Eucharist nourish you as you travel on the road of hope." Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.